So nice to have you back, Larry, on this podcast.
Thank you, as always.
And let's get started with what's going on in the Middle East. We've learned that the U.S. commander of CENTCOM is in Israel. Do we know what's going on there?
No. I mean, we can speculate. Number one, it may be tied to the fact that the United States leaked last week, towards the end of the week, that told Israel, hey, we can't keep all these air assets and naval assets in there forever. You know, we're going to have to start pulling them out. So you better take that into account no matter what you're going to do. And I suspect that's the main reason that this General Kurilla went over there. I was just trying to look him up. I think he's out of the army. But his background is army. So he's probably over there to say you need to plan accordingly. Now, some have speculated that maybe coordinating joint military operations between Israel and the United States. Possible, but I think it's unlikely. Number one, the last thing that anybody in the Biden administration wants before the elections in November is to start another shooting war where you're going to get Americans killed. And there's clearly no strong incentive among the voting populace to get engaged in another overseas war, just the opposite. So I think Kurilla is trying to coordinate with Israel, saying, whatever you got planned, be aware we can't keep these guys here forever, and maybe even trying to put some notify them of limitations of what the U.S. response will be.
And do they have right now, in your opinion, are they forcing, putting some sort of pressure on the Netanyahu administration, or just they're asking them? Because it depends the way that they're trying to do this.
Well, they can put some pressure. I suspect, let me put this way. The United States is in a position to put pressure on, but up to this point has not had the political will to put pressure on Israel. Meanwhile, you've got Netanyahu being bombastic about, wanting to attack into Lebanon and take on Hezbollah and give, reportedly giving orders to the military to do so. Well, this is the same kind of foolishness we saw out of Ukraine. And again, that was with NATO involvement back in the start of their counteroffensive in June of 2023. They kept announcing, we're going to come. Here we come. We're coming. We're going to hit you. We're going to launch a major counteroffensive. Last time I checked, real professional military leaders are like really good poker players. They hide their cards and they try not to give away what they intend to do. Both Israel and Ukraine, and to a lesser extent, United States and NATO, they're terrible card players. God, good Lord, they're showing their cards, what they're going to do. They got all sorts of tells, all wide-eyed and mouth open. So what I think is going on right now with Kurilla, that he's trying to lay out what the reality is of what the United States can do, what it cannot do, and that to notify the Israelis, hey, you're on a clock now. We're going to be pulling out. Or the current forces deployed are going to be withdrawn, and we don't have any immediate replacements. That may come as a bit of a shock to Israel.
What's so amazing right now between Israel and Hezbollah is before Netanyahu going to the United States, he was trying to convince the United States to give some sort of permission to them to attack Hezbollah, if you remember. And when he went to the United States, came back and they attacked, they killed these two commanders of Hamas. And then the United States was warning Hezbollah not to attack Israel because they were doing some sort of negotiations. And right now, again, they want to attack Hezbollah. Do we know what they're seeking for right now? And why do they want to do that?
Who, you mean Israel?
Israel.
Well, I mean, Israel's got about almost 100,000 settlers of kibbutzim that have had to flee because they're being hit with Hezbollah rockets. What's fascinating is, you know, Israel is good at talking a tough game. You know, they make threats. If you listen to their words, they are the most formidable army military force in the world. But then you get down to their actual performance. They're really good at dropping bombs on unarmed women and children. They have trouble sustaining their forces in the field because it's largely a reserve force, and these soldiers have to get back to their families and their businesses. As far as being sophisticated fighters, they're not. They really have not gone head to head with Hezbollah on the ground in 18 years. Last time was 2006. He is, if you look at him, the Israelis are in a position that on the one hand, Netanyahu is asking the military to do something that the military actually may not be capable of doing right now because of lack of supplies and lack of trained personnel with reservists who, you know, have to return home and then they have to call up a new batch who are not necessarily well-trained. So it's a real odd situation. And you saw after this last exchange, that's 2 weeks ago, where Israel reportedly claimed they struck a bunch of missile rocket sites in Lebanon, Syria, belonging to Hezbollah. None of those strikes apparently were north of the Litani River, at least in Lebanon. And then Hezbollah retaliated by hitting Israel. Israel claimed, oh, they didn't lay a glove on us. But there are strong indications that, in fact, Hezbollah did hit its targets, particularly the base that houses Unit 8200, which collects intelligence, electronic intelligence for the Israelis. So, you know, they're right now they're in a bit of a standoff, and if you listen to Netanyahu's rhetoric, they're going to escalate. But you know, it's one thing; it'd be like you saying, "Man, I'm going to go out and run a 2 hour and 30 minute marathon." Now, you can say that all you want, but unless you've trained to do it, and, you know, unless you've gotten good at running sub-4-minute miles, the odds that you're going to do that in, 2.5 hours is real slim, impossible. That's what I think sort of the Israelis are going through right now. They talk tough, they say a lot of inflammatory things, but they don't actually have the muscle to back it up.
And in your opinion, right now with the current situation of Israel on the battlefield and their economy, does Iran really need to attack Israel or respond to Israel? Or they can just let Israel the way that they're just not winning the conflict, they're just, their economy is not doing great right now, and we don't have any sort of conflict between Iran and the United States. How do you find right now Iran and their policy?
Well, I think Iran is being much more thoughtful about what they're going to do. Despite the impression that's cultivated in the West that the Iranians are a bunch of emotional children who just react according to the moment. I don't think things through. It's just the opposite. They are more like chess players, assessing moves and assessing what, you know, if we do this, what's the other side going to do? And if the other side does what we anticipate that they'll do, what we need to do. So they're thinking 2, 3, 4 moves ahead. And they've got some assistance with that because the Russians, that's how they approach the issues. United States, man, we're checker players. Boy, we play immediate jump a piece and that's it. We don't think through strategically what the implications are. So it's very possible that Iran has assessed the situation and said, hey, let's keep rattling our sword. Let's keep, giving the impression that we're going to hit Israel and force them to stay at a level of readiness that's going to actually tax their system. It's going to degrade their system because you can only stay alert for so long before that alert level is going to wear off. And so, it's possible Iran's just biding his time. But, I've in our previous conversations, I reminded you that it was 1988 in July when the United States blew up hit a civilian, an Iranian civilian airliner with a surface-to-air missile. And blew it up, killed all these civilian passengers. That Iran waited 6 months before they retaliated in the person of blowing up Pan Am 103. At least, I share Robert Baer's beliefs that Iran was ultimately behind that operation, even though there were Libyans involved. It was ultimately done at the behest of Iran. So, I could see Iran waiting another 2 years. They're going to exact revenge, a payback on Israel. But they're going to do it in the time of their choosing and the place of their choosing. And they're not going to be driven by Israeli or U.S. expectations. And it's worth noting, look how many false warnings we've had from both Israel and the U.S. intelligence community over the last 5-6 weeks. Oh, they're going to hit tomorrow. Oh, they're going to hit this weekend. Oh, they're going to hit Monday. It's always a wrong prediction so far.
Yeah. How do you see the situation of Netanyahu administration considering what's going on inside Israel? It seems that they're asking the administration to go after some sort of negotiations in order to release those hostages and the Hamas.
There is a strong vocal minority that wants to get rid of Netanyahu and wants the negotiations to go on. The let's call it the European Israelis that at one point dominated, they are not necessarily supportive of Netanyahu, and they would like to see a deal with Hamas done. But it looks like still a majority of the country is in the pockets of the native Israelis, the ones who don't necessarily hail their European roots, that are considered more than the locals or from sub-Saharan Africa. They support Netanyahu, so I think Netanyahu still has majority support so far. But you're right, there is great political division in Israel. It's just that those who oppose Netanyahu at this point do not appear to be in the majority.
And in your opinion, who has the upper hand in Israel? Are they American Jews or European Jews?
Oh, well, I'd say the American Jews. Or those, let's call them the ultra-Zionists. There's even a movement, there's organizations here in the United States called Zionists of America, ZOA. You've got this split in Israel between these, let's call them the secular Jews, those who don't really consider themselves Jewish, don't adhere to the tenets of Judaism, are not observant religiously. And then you've got this segment within the Zionist elements who are ultra extremists in their views, to the point that all land was given to them by God from the river to the sea, and they're going to take it. And let's draw a contrast between them and the Hasidic Jewish community. The Hasidic community actually reject they're aligned more with the European non-believing Jews. But then from their standpoint, they believe that you cannot have the nation of Israel until the Messiah returns. And the Messiah hasn't returned as far as they're concerned. Therefore, what's being done by the Israeli government is illegal in their mind.
And we had Lavrov in visiting Saudi Arabia. And one of the points that he has been talking about was the state of Palestine. It seems that for Saudi Arabia is so important because they were talking about it right after that. Lavrov was pointing out that we have to have a state of Palestine. How serious do you find it right now for Saudi Arabia? Because when you talk about this with Russia, it seems that you're seeking for some sort of solution in that direction.
Yeah, I think we've seen, you know, the key players in this, in the region, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, Jordan. You know, those four really, I think, would be in a position to put some enormous pressure on Israel to change what it's doing. But Israel's not going to change. Yeah, that's the thing, Nima. People just need to stop kidding themselves to think that, oh, we just need to come up with the right list of suggestions or recommendations, and that the Israelis would go, oh, my God, why didn't we think of that? Yeah, let's do that. There's no negotiation. There's no compromise here. The Zionists want the Palestinians gone, whether they go through death or through exile or through expulsion. They don't care, just as long as they're gone. They want that land, all of it. Gaza, the West Bank, hell, they'll even take Jordan if they had their druthers. So, you know, they're not going to change. So you can't change them. But what you can do, or they won't voluntarily change. But what you can do is force them, compel them, and that means cutting off their ability to defend themselves, so that they are finally vulnerable to extinction themselves, and then have a combination of the West, the United States with Russia and China step in to separate the sides. I mean, it's this like, you know, two people who are engaged in a life and death struggle. They're just brawling with each other. You got to separate. You got to stop the fight, number one. You know, get them apart and then keep them apart. You may physically have to, you know, interpose yourself. Doesn't mean that they're going to ever get along. You know, maybe someday they might. But, you know, for right now, you got to shut them down. And you know, that's, I think, the only thing that would bring an end to all of this. But barring that, until Saudi Arabia and Turkey really step up and say, okay, this has got to come to an end. Cause you know, up to this point, the Saudis have been trying to play, you know, created an official relationship with Israel under the Abraham Accords. And Turkey, despite all of its previous heated rhetoric, had still, you know, leaving a door open to work with Israel. But that may be closing, because you saw the Turks now have announced they're going to join BRICS. It's official, wanting to get in there. You could see if they make a decisive turn against Israel and cut the oil off. And the Saudis also do not ensure that no more oil goes to Israel through, you know, some back channel. Then the Israelis are going to be, they're going to be compelled to negotiate. They're going to have to do something.
Yeah. Whenever we talk about Israel and its decision of the Netanyahu administration, people are talking about these polls that shows how the majority of the people in Israel are supporting the Netanyahu administration, right, their policy in Gaza. But Larry, at the end of the day, the way that the look at the hostages right now, how they feel the necessity of having some sort of negotiations because they have something to lose. And it seems that if these countries decide to modify their policy toward Israel, they're gonna, the population, those people in Israel, would learn that they have to consider all these concerns coming from other countries.
No, they don't. Why would they have to consider? You know, Nima, frankly, they don't give a shit what the rest of the world thinks. They don't care. You know, they've got over 5,000, maybe the number's 10,000 Palestinians that have been taken hostage. These Palestinians are in no different circumstance than those Israelis that were taken hostage by the Palestinians and Hamas, except they're held in a more known locations, these Israeli prisons, but they've not been charged with any crime. They've been picked up, they've been tortured, they've been beaten. Frankly, the hostages that the Hamas has have been better treated by Hamas than the Israelis treat the Palestinians, hands down. And that's why these hostages were taken in the first place. People, you know, the Western lie is that Hamas just did this because they're terrorists. They hate us for our freedom. No, they were trying to get some bargaining leverage because the world stands by as Israel at what just gets up in the morning because it feels like it and will arrest, detain kids as young as 9 and 10 years old and put them in jail. Again, with not having committed a crime, without being charged with a crime, without being offered any due process whatsoever, because they're subhuman. They're not worthy of due process. That's what Hamas was trying to counter. That's why they grabbed the hostages. And now we're seeing that Israel's own doctrine of killing the hostages or killing Israelis if they're in danger of becoming a hostage.
And shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine right now, what was the outcome of this attitude of the part of the Zelensky administration? They're asking for more weapons. They're asking for more money from the United States, from the European Union. So far, we know that Sweden is going to send them and 300 million, I don't know if 400 million euros, and the United States is going to send them $250 million.
Yeah.
And how this type of money, how this type of attitude would help them? Do you think, is that going to change anything for Ukrainians right now?
Heavens no. In fact, they didn't get anything they really asked for. They didn't get a commitment for more air defense or any air defense that works credibly. The United States doesn't have any more ATACMs to give them. No more HIMARS to give them. No more 155 millimeter howitzer shells. It's like the old Mother Hubbard went to the cupboard and found the cupboard was bare. The United States inventory has been stripped, not just the United States, NATO. So, yeah, NATO and some of the NATO countries, Germany, they're sending some elderly leopards. That is just the only thing they're not sending is a rocking chair. Okay, this is old equipment. It's not latest greatest. It's not the most modern. And by virtue of being old, I can tell you, old people break down. Things that worked when they're 30 doesn't work when they're 70, you know? And same with military hardware and equipment. So, you know, Zelensky got a lot of lip service, but, you know, he's begging, please, please, you know, give me those long-range missiles so we can attack deep inside Russia. And then Lloyd Austin, boy, did a tap dance that, you know, the put him on Broadway as a dancer, you know, be one of the Rockettes. He danced around the issue, but basically said, no, you're not getting them.
And this policy, Larry, it seems comes from the, what's the name of this guy? He's always with Zelensky. Yermak.
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 Yeah. He was his agent. You know, he was his agent. Big, burly, drunken guy. You know, he's actually the one that's the power behind the throne, telling Zelensky what to do, etc. He's the one that the U.S. officials talk to. So go ahead. Your question about him was?
Yeah, the question is, these are right-wing people. These are those ultra-nationalists who are running the show. Zelensky doesn't do anything, in my opinion. And the way that they're managing this situation, do you think the United States going to be able to convince them? Because right now, it doesn't seem that they do want to negotiate. They want to continue this conflict. And nobody knows what's in their mind and what would be the outcome of this type of mindset.
Well, the Ukrainians, the Yermaks, the Zelenskys, their idea of negotiation is Russia's got to surrender. And I guess you could say Russia holds the same view, except that the one that has to surrender is Ukraine. So you step back and let's look at the battlefield. What's happening on the battlefield? Who is advancing kilometers every day? That would be Russia, not Ukraine. Who's suffering more casualties? That would be Ukraine, not Russia. Who has more drones? Russia. Who has more planes? Russia. Who has more tanks? Russia. Who has more artillery pieces? Russia. Who has more of every weapon system than the other side? That's Russia. Who has more trained soldiers? Russia. So, okay, explain to me how the Ukraine's going to achieve some sort of magical outcome and turn the tables on Russia. Just not going to happen. And this was, you know, I was predicting this more than 2 years ago, just because the nature of the imbalance. I didn't realize the training side would get so desperate. And hell, you even had Sursky. You know, I wrote a piece a week ago Monday. It's the training stupid. And I think we talked about it a little bit with you in the previous discussion. Well, Sursky came out and confirmed what I was saying. He admitted that right now they're only training these guys maybe a total of 4 weeks, if that, and then sending them to the front. Well, you know, my point was you need a minimum 6 months training to even have a fighting chance to be a functioning soldier at the front. And these guys on the Ukrainian side are barely doing 2 weeks, 2 to 4 weeks. No wonder they're suffering massive casualties. You know what? And they're causing a lot of friendly, what they call friendly fire deaths. They're shooting their own guys. Because part of the training, like even when you're training with firearms, is learning where you can point, when you can shoot, how to identify if somebody's friend or foe. Do you have a password? Do you have a challenge? You know, halt, who goes there? What's the color of the day? Chartreuse, you know. So, but you don't even get to that level of training with these guys. And then they're just getting killed by shortly after they arrive in many cases.
Right now, in your opinion, European Union is more radical or less radical toward Ukraine, toward the way that they're helping Ukraine? Are they getting some lessons from the conflict, or they're not? They're just blind.
Blind, still blind. They are heavily invested to the extent that they can invest, but you know they're a non-entity economically within the world. You know, Germany was the heart of the European economy. Well, it's got the equivalent of heart disease now, suffering a heart attack, major heart attack. I mean, good God, they're talking about closing Volkswagen or Volkswagen plants in Germany. I don't think that hasn't happened since Adolf Hitler was driving around in a Volkswagen during its early days. So, you know, Europe, oh yeah, we're going to continue to support Ukraine, except, again, they say one thing. They're good at moving their mouth. They're bad at actually delivering on what they promised to deliver. And the Ukrainians have taken note of that and complained.
Orban, how about Orban? He just started talking again about the conflict, but he doesn't seem that nobody seems to care about him and what he's talking about.
No,
and even in Slovakia, they have Fico talking about it.
Yeah, right now all you've got is Fico, Orban, and maybe the good folks in Serbia. That's it. Most of the other Europeans seem quite content to go along with business as usual, and still we're going to stick with Ukraine to the bitter end. That may be coming sooner rather than later.
One of the recently Trump had a talk and somebody asked him about their policy, his policy toward Russia. He said he's willing to decrease the sanctions against Russia and Iran.
Yeah.
And when, in your opinion, when the European Union looks at what's going on in the United States right now and the way that Trump may win, and he has a very good chance of winning 2024. And do they really fear what's going on in the United States, or they're not just, they don't care what's going on there?
Oh, yeah. No, I think they're frightened beyond belief. Donald Trump terrifies a lot of the Europeans. You know, I remember I was in England in the last week of October in 2016. I was running a counter-surveillance course for a group of journalists out of Eastern Europe, teaching them how to pick up surveillance and try to, keep themselves safe. And I was working with some former Scotland Yard guys. I'd hired them to do some of the instruction. I met with just a recently retired British diplomat. And boy, if you were casting a movie, this is the guy he'd cast. He's got his nose in the air and he's got this effete accent and, very precise in his pronunciation and just an arrogance factor. And he's wearing the pinstripes, but the seersucker suit, And boy, the subject of Donald Trump came up, and I raised this. I said, "Well, no, I think Trump actually has a viable path to victory." And he was just, aghast. Oh, you got to be kidding! Trump's bad, because he's gonna mess up our party at NATO. So yeah, they don't want Trump. Fascinates me is the self-destruction that the Europeans are engaged in right now. Because Germany is genuinely suffering economically in ways that it's been years since they've experienced this level of loss. And all Olaf Scholz can do is talk about, the Saturday Night Live, more cowbell. We need to give more support to Ukraine. It's like, dude, step back. Put your gun down. The majority of your people don't support the policy. We're in a situation where the leadership is ignoring what the will of the majority of their populace want. And so they very well could create just a national security catastrophe if they keep following this line of support for Ukraine.
And United States right now, whoever gonna win the 2024 presidential election gonna have a huge problem, considering Ukraine, considering in Asia, in the Middle East right now. Larry, we know what's going on in Ukraine and in the Middle East. Do you think that the United States, the way that they're failing to understand what's going on in these two regions, they're going to fail in Asia as well?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Look, the policymakers in the United States and much of the public are just ignorant, blinded by ideology about China, about Russia, about Iran, about North Korea. I don't maintain that, you know, China is some sort of democratic utopia, some great paradise. China's got a lot of problems, but I'm more of the view that the United States ought to act like a recovering addict. Instead of going out telling other people what they need to do to clean up their own acts, let's clean up our own act first. Because we spent, you know, almost most of all of my all life, you know, since 1955, we've been involved with one war or another, you know, whether it's Vietnam or Central America or Africa or Middle East, you know, now Ukraine. And it hasn't made us safer. Hasn't made the world more secure, and all it has accomplished is to bankrupt the United States Treasury. Now, we've gotten away with it because we were the reserve currency. So if you wanted to do anything with buying oil and such, you had to do it with dollars. Well, that's going away, and you know, we'll probably have a definitive answer from BRICS by the end of October. That there will be an alternative financial system out there now that will start heavily trafficking in business that once was the purview of the U.S. dollar almost exclusively. So this this misunderstanding of China and of Russia and of Iran, where we have to cast, we always are casting it in existential threats. Like we worry about what China's doing in the South China Sea. Now think about that. What interest, what right does the United States have to worry about what's going on in the South China Sea? We're sticking our nose in there. We're going to make it part of our business. Well, if China was doing that in the Caribbean, to the extent that we're doing it in South China Sea, we would be at war immediately with China. We would see that as a direct violation of our sovereignty, of the Monroe Doctrine. So what's happening is the United States is very much in a reactive mode. It's not thinking strategically. It's really acting very emotionally. More like a 13-year-old girl, just with no rational thought, no clear understanding of what is our interest. What is it that we, the United States, want to accomplish? It would seem to me that our goals and would be, number one, we want to make sure that we can produce all the energy we need to support ourselves and or have access to oil and natural gas from other countries if needed, that we would be able to trade on a basis that would be beneficial to us, number one. We want to make sure we've got a secure supply of food. We want to make sure that we got a sound industrial base that we can produce essential items needed to defend ourselves. But we haven't done that at all. You know, we've walked away from that. So the United States is in a position of a great weakness right now. Oh, you're muted.
if you remember when this war started, and we've heard that Iran is sending drones to Russia. In the beginning, they were just denying that we are not sending that those drones to Russia, and we're not doing. Right now, Larry, the policy is changing drastically. Right now, they're sending ballistic missiles. They're just saying that we're sending them. Because mm-hmm. it seems that these countries, that China, the way that China was behaving when this conflict in Ukraine started, they were talking about that. No, we are not that much support in Russia. Right now, we know that they're just saying it, that we are helping Russia, and nobody mm-hmm. can do nothing about it. And this is the way that the policy is changing little by little, but it doesn't seem that in the United States they do understand what's going on and how the countries are just putting out what they're doing, and they don't have any sort of fear from the United States.
Well, no. I mean, you know, the United States can threaten to go to war with them, but there's very little we can do from a war standpoint, short of using nuclear weapons. And if we use nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons are going to be used against us. So, you know, we've reached in our, you know, the, let's call it, this modern age is exposing the limitations of U.S. military power. And that's something the United States Congress, United States political class haven't come to grips with, whether it's Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. They just ignore that. And, you know, when you try to point this out, you can be accused of being un-American or whatever, but, you know, the truth is the truth. And the other thing we're missing out on is what Iran, what China, what North Korea, any weapon systems that they are supplying to Russia, not necessarily because Russia needs it and is in desperate straits, but it's a way for those countries to test in combat conditions whether those systems work or not. Because the reality is that's what we've seen happening with NATO systems, that HIMARS and Patriots, that we thought, oh, these are really great systems, turns out they don't work so well. Or they've been countered. It gives the Russians a chance to work on them and counter them as well. So,
and just to wrap up this session, Larry, I think what's mostly missing right now is the lack of diplomacy on the part of the United States. Yeah. That's why the way that Russia, Iran, and China just talking about supporting Russia, we're going to have the same type of manner as you're witnessing right now in Turkey and maybe in Saudi Arabia. Little by little, these moves are so small, but at the end of the day, when you put all of them together, all these pieces together, you see this would be a drastic change in their policy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, let's bring it down to a sort of a personal, simple level. So you're married, you have a wife, you got kids. And let's say two gay guys move in next door to you. Now, you're not a supporter or an encourager of homosexual rights. Now you got a choice. You either can attack them, and because they reject, you know, your values are not their values. You reject what they stand for. Or you find a way to get along with them. Maybe find that maybe they can be good neighbors. And maybe they're not, you know, as long as what they do in the privacy of their home. It's the same way with other countries. I mean, you don't have to like Russia. You don't have to like China. And China and Russia don't necessarily have to like us. You know, there are things to like in each country and things to dislike. The point is, can you find a foundation, a basis where you can talk to each other? You can live peacefully, coexist without threatening each other with violence. Because when you leave the choice of that, your only choice is really to kill the other person, destroy them. You know, you're taking the most ultimate extreme step possible. So since we don't try to do that, like when I teach self-defense with firearms, the very last thing I teach a student to do, the very last thing is to shoot and kill somebody else. That is the last thing you want to do. Why? I mean, there's so many problems that can arise from that. So walk away if you can. Extract yourself if you can. De-escalate if you can. You know, but if you're in a position where your life is actually at threat, then yeah, fine, defend yourself. Well, I think those same principles can apply to the world of politics, international relations. And we never want to put another country in a position of feeling that they're an existential threat or that we're going to extinguish them. But, you know, we don't have that kind of mindset anymore, at least in the United States. You see it among Lavrov, you see it among the Chinese, you even see it among the Iranians. The rest of the world is sort of looking at the United States. So they look at us and say, these Americans, they've lost their damn minds.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Here I am, Mr. Cheeriness and good news, right?
See you on Friday, Larry.
All right. Thank you, Nima. Bye-bye.